Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, winter as a season for retreating from the world to build back the strength we need to cope. We'll spend this hour with writer Catherine May, who found herself plunged into a metaphorical winter when she and her husband both suffered serious illnesses and their six-year-old son's severe anxiety meant he needed homeschooling. May was forced to pull back from her career for a season of rest and focus on her family, and also to learn to live with new limitations on her life. And she became determined to teach her son that it's okay, even necessary, to make time and space to regroup rather than forcing oneself to carry on as if nothing bad had happened. Our conversation starts after a short break.
Funding for the Think podcast comes from TCU, exploring renewable and sustainable energy sources to power a clean energy future. Stories of research can be found at endeavors.tcu.edu.
As we look around at naked trees and yellow grass, shiver through cold nights and long for the plentiful, seemingly endless sunlight of summer, it's really easy to misunderstand winter. We sometimes talk about things as if they're dead when, in fact, they're dormant. The radiant blooms of spring and summer are made possible by the temporary retreat of living things. They burrow, they nest, they hunker underground to regain their strength. Maybe it works that way for people, too. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Catherine May is a journalist and author who has found herself grateful for times of dormancy that allow her to recover from illness, grief, and disappointment to emerge ready to face the world with renewed vigor. Make no mistake, nobody welcomes the events that force us into these metaphorical seasons of withdrawal. But May has realized that winter is part of every life, just as it's part of every year. And she says it's a life skill to accept and embrace these cold, dark months as a time for growth and healing. Her book is called Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, welcome to Think.
Hello.
What does the season of winter represent to you that makes it so different from spring or summer or autumn?
Oh, I think winter's a really special time of year. I'm a winter fan. I know that I will not be taking everyone with me when I express that opinion. but that's okay. My shoulders are broad. But I think that winter is special because it takes us into a space of which we have no choice but to go into, of deep contemplation. It forces us into isolation from the rest of the world because it's so cold and dark. And it makes us slow down, relax, listen to the world around us, and to start to maybe plan for the next stage.
I think we all know, just like annual seasons in many parts of the world, a few metaphorical winters are inevitable in every life. Why do we find it so easy to forget this and to be surprised or even ashamed when something happens that forces us to step back for a while?
Well, I think that, I mean, all of our culture kind of conspires to tell us that those winters don't happen. We don't really talk about them. We don't share the details of them. When they're happening to us, we tend to hide away and maybe try and cover up what's happening. And I think that so much of our conversation about how to live life is about the positives. You know, we don't want to look at the negatives. We don't want to admit that sometimes we fail or we screw up. And sometimes that people betray us or just stuff goes wrong. All of those things are quite unacceptable in the mainstream. And maybe we decide to, you know, hide ourselves away in our bear cave, if you like, while it's all happening.
You write here that you learned to winter at a young age. What made your childhood feel cold so often?
Well, I was a child who suffered depression very young. And, you know, like, I'm 43. I think we can get that out there. When I was a child, talking about being depressed to adults, you'd hear, oh no, children can't get depressed. And so it was kind of denied for a long time. And it was only when I was 38 that I finally got a diagnosis of autism, which had always been there. Obviously, it hadn't appeared when I was 38, but that wouldn't have been possible when I was a child. And so what it meant was that I grew up feeling very isolated, very different from other people, very anxious, very overwhelmed in all kinds of different situations. And I wasn't able to ever express that or explain it or to, you know, particularly to find any ways of ameliorating it. So that meant that I became very familiar with that space on the edge of things, that liminal space that I talk about. And with the experience, I suppose, of outsidership and having to walk with sadness.
Your sense is that the healing of winter can't really begin until we stop wishing it were summer. That's easier said than done, though, right? How do we get past that powerful desire to be living through a very different reality?
Yeah, I mean, winter is a painful season to go through, the metaphorical one and actually the physical one. It snowed near me today, so I'm remembering just how cold and wet snow is. It doesn't happen often. I don't think we come past it easily, you know? I don't think it's a simple thing, or else we'd all be breezing through these times. I think it's a slow process that you actually can't rush, you know, that it's almost there's a narrative arc to it. You go into your winter, you maybe resist it a bit, you get into that deep wintering stage where really you are feeling at your lowest ebb and at your most desperate for things to be okay. And then gradually, I think what happens is that you have to accept your wintering. You're forced into it because there's no other way out of it. And once you do that, you can begin to make the changes that you need to make in order to go to the next phase of your life. You know, and they're not always welcome changes. Let's be honest about that. I mean, you know, say with me in the book, I talked about, you know, my illness that came on. Which is multiple problems with my gut and my digestive system. And they'll be with me forever, and they are probably degenerative as well. And the last thing I wanted to do was have to radically change my diet. You know, I always prided myself in being able to eat anything, which, you know, maybe is what got me there in the first place, who knows? But actually, you know, by making those changes, it's annoying and it cuts down, you know, so many things that I used to love doing, but it's what I had to do to get through. And now, a couple of years on, it just seems like normal life. And I feel pleased that I'm able to manage it rather than to keep getting ill and being in pain all the time. So it's those kind of adjustments that we're often being invited to make. And we don't feel better for whatever reason until we've managed to make them, I don't think.
So your husband got very sick and nearly died. You had health problems that it took a while for your doctors to even figure out. So you took this leave of absence from your job at a university. And at first, it sounds like being home was not such a comfort because suddenly you have the time to look around and notice, like, that wall needs to be painted, that counter is chipped. Why haven't I swept the floor? You started realizing how you sacrificed time for so long in order to take care of everyone else and everything else on your priority list.
Yeah, and I think actually loads of us had that experience at the beginning of the pandemic as well. You know, I had been working so hard for so long. I'd bounced from having a young child to going into a full-time job that was really all-encompassing. And I was kind of running scared, you know. I was running to catch up. I had so much work to do, and I, you know, passionate about it and wanted to do it well. I wanted to be a good mother. I wanted to have a social life as well. You know, that kind of having it all thing, you know, becomes very relevant to this conversation all of a sudden. And even as I'm listing them, it maybe begins to sound exhausting because you can't do all of that well without any help. And, you know, I've never had any help, really. I don't have any childcare. So that means that I had this strong sense that everything was degrading around me, you know, that the house was falling to rack and ruin, that everything was untidy and a bit dirty and a bit ill-kempt. And only when I stopped did I really absorb the kind of horror of that almost. I mean, look, I'm never going to be a massively tidy, house proud person. I wish I was. But actually, it was more than that. It was about how life frays around the edges if we don't take care of the small things, and those small things are important. And I felt like there was this big build-up in my home of, you know, rot, you know, not literal rot, but of stuff falling apart, of stuff that was tired, of, you know, those kind of collections of things that happen in every corner of the room and you can't work out what where they're supposed to be, but they seem to gather like dust. And I think that showed me that it wasn't just the stuff that was suffering in my life. It was that was a kind of metaphor for how my life was going, that I wasn't maintaining the basics because I was just in such a rush to keep up all the time. And when winter came, I had to look at all of that and evaluate it and really think about how I wanted to cope with everything in the future.
You were genuinely unwell. And on top of that, you had this paranoia that somebody would think you were malingering. Why do you think you felt guilty about needing time off?
Oh, goodness. Well, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And I think, well, I think we all do, though, don't we? I mean, I don't think anyone, you know, enters a time of ill health without thinking, what does everyone else think about this? Mm. And I was really quite overtaken by kind of paranoia, really, this thought that everybody would be gossiping about me, or even worse, that they wouldn't be mentioning me at all. And that was linked to the fact that until everything fell through, I thought that they needed me to hold it all together. And I had to slowly come to terms with the idea that actually they could get by without me. And that was hard too, because then you realise that you've been throwing yourself wholeheartedly at this thing for years, that actually when you go off sick, it kind of carries on. That's a hard thought. It was good for me in the end, but that was very, very painful, I think. And also, I mean, it was circumstantial for me too, because I'd handed my notice in. I'd already decided that it was time for me to leave, that I couldn't cope with it any longer. But I'd done that just that bit too late. And so I ended up getting sick while I was waiting out my notice. And so I kind of thought, oh, I bet everybody thinks that I've just done that deliberately. You know, I've got nothing to lose anymore. And it obsessed me for a long time. And I think loads of people will relate to that, actually, unfortunately.
So it was your doctor who convinced you that it might actually be good for you to physically get away for a while. How did you end up choosing Iceland in the middle of winter?
Well, I've always been drawn to the far north. But actually, Iceland had been booked before it all began. It was a present for my 40th birthday. And by the time it came round, I was already ill and I was off sick from work. And so I thought, well, okay, I'm going to need my doctor to write me a letter to get me out of this so that I can get my money back. But my doctor said, you know, you don't know what's coming up. You should take the trip. What difference does it make? What difference does it make if you're in a foreign country? As long as you have got health insurance and as long as, you know, you're safe, go and enjoy yourself. And that gave me real pause for thought, because I feel like doctors know, you know, they see life falling apart all the time. And there was some real wisdom there. As it turned out, it didn't go so well because I just got sicker when I got there. I don't think anyone could have predicted that.
You had brought a whole bunch of new, I guess, challenging books, and yet you found yourself drawn to download a book that I gather you had loved as a girl.
Yeah, well, actually, I mean, it came out a little bit after I was a girl. It came out when I was in my late teens, I think. But Philip Pullman's Northern Lights trilogy, I mean, it spoke to the landscape I was in. It spoke to that very northern landscape with northern lights and snow and, you know, maybe the suggestion of a polar bear somewhere or other. But also there was something about that heroic narrative, I think, at that point, and the very complicated heroine of Lyra that I needed. You know, the simplicity of children's books. I mean, Philip Pullman's books aren't terribly simple, but they are these narratives where good and evil get into a confrontation and duke it out. And I think sometimes we need those big narratives to help us through. We don't need anything too smart. We need something that is actually going to take us into the space of thinking about the battle that's raging inside us, maybe. They are beautiful books as well, I should add.
My guest is journalist and author Catherine May. We're talking about her new book. It's called Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist and author Catherine May about her new book, Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, many of us try to live through winter in similar ways as we live through the other seasons, but with a jacket. Your friend from Finland told you the approach there is really different. People even allow their body clocks to change with the seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in Finland, particularly in the north, they're experiencing really extreme seasonal changes. And they have to not only adapt when winter comes, but prepare really carefully. So Hanna Malinen, who I've interviewed, explained to me that they start preparing in July or August by, you know, picking mushrooms and soft fruit to preserve. And that's definitely with winter in mind, because by the time September comes, it's starting to get cold. And they also have to make sure that their houses are really weatherproof before that all comes, because once snow's arrived, they're in trouble if, you know, heavy snowfall makes their roof leak, because they won't be able to repair it. So the whole of their year is pointed towards winter. But when that snowfall actually comes, they know that they need to find ways to keep life as pleasurable as possible. Because if you're snowed in, if your life gets very restricted, and, you know, spot the analogy to these troubled times, if you haven't got what you need to live a happy life, then life gets very unhappy. And the Finns know really well that that can be a problem. You know, they have very high rates of alcoholism, of suicide, of domestic abuse, of depression. So they do all they can to make life okay. And that means having a freezer full of good things. You know, there's a kind of Finnish custom that if anyone drops around, you always have to be ready to serve them cake. Because you're ready with that hospitality to create that sense of warmth. But also it points to the massive importance of sauna in Finnish culture. I think, you know, we see sauna as this like lovely thing that you might do if you go to a spa for a day, or if you're staying at a nice hotel. But the Finns see having access to a sauna as just as important to having access to a bathroom. I mean, it really is that fundamental to them. And there's all kinds of sort of symbolic significance to the sauna. You know, it's only recently that they stopped laying their dead out in the sauna, and that, you know, Hannah's grandmother gave birth in the sauna, which I find incredibly difficult to imagine. I know. I mean, let's not even let our mind go. Just but it's also a family time, a kind of break in the day. And she talks about this kind of mindset of in sauna, which is this dreamy contemplative mindset that happens when you and your loved ones sit together and chat. And I think for them, it's just this way of breaking up those really bleak winter days and nights.
You write about your son's desire to kind of do Halloween, which you weren't really all that excited about. How have our modern customs obscured the actual point of the ancient celebration?
Well, I mean, I think we shouldn't get too grumpy about that. But in the UK, the Halloween has come to us very recently, really, in terms of the big kind of dressing up celebration. I mean, certainly when I was a child, it was there, but fireworks night on the 5th of November was much more important. That's when we, you know, celebrate our parliament nearly being blown up. Maybe Halloween replaced that for quite good reason. But, you know, for like my son's generation, Halloween is probably as big for them as it is in the States. It just seems like a really key moment in their calendar. And I'm not really sure when that happened, but a shift has definitely come. I think the thing is that when you go into a festival without really understanding the fundaments of it and the complexity of the meaning behind it, it can end up being quite shallow, and it can end up quickly becoming quite materialistic. The celebration of Halloween has definitely got its roots in the British Isles and in Celtic mythology, certainly. So it's something we lost and have come back to rather than something we never had, maybe. And I don't think I really realised that until I researched the book. But what we've left behind is this idea of remembering our dead and our loved ones and our ancestors. And instead, it's become more about kind of, you know, something very shallow about dressing up and having sweets, really. And I'm interested in returning to those ideas of memorialising the sad parts of life and finding ways to punctuate the year with that emotional work that we actually need to do. And I think Halloween could come back to us as a much more meaningful and quite spiritual time, actually. I mean, it's certainly still very present in mainland Europe in the form of All Saints Day and All Souls Day in the couple of days following, when everyone queues up to get to the local cemeteries to tend their graves. So I think it's really, really interesting. And I'm in lots of ways, I'm really glad he's brought it back into the house. But I think it's time for us to think really hard about what we then want to do with that festival, so it doesn't just become about buying more stuff, because I am so tired of that.
I'm with you on that one. I want to talk about insomnia. Lots of people wrestle with this, especially in difficult times. For me, what's always been hard about not sleeping is that feeling of isolation, right? It seems like everyone else in the world is lost to sleep and you are awake and alert through the night. How did you learn to reframe that time so that you could almost embrace it rather than dreading every minute of it?
Oh, totally. I think we always think that we are awake alone. But when you start to talk to people, loads and loads of us sleep really badly, particularly in the winter. And that's really interesting, because when you look at the history of our sleep, it's only very recently, of course, that we got electric light. And that has changed our waking patterns. That's changed the way we approach sleep. So before the Industrial Revolution and even later than that, in the winter, we'd have had to have gone to bed really early because light would have failed. And even if we could have afforded the candlelight, it would have not been really very useful light. You know, people talked a lot more about eye strain in those days than we have to worry about now. And so people fell into this very well-established pattern of going to bed not long after sunset, sleeping for maybe 4 or 5 hours, and then waking in the middle of the night for what, I mean, it didn't really have a standard name, but you might call it the watch. That was how it was sometimes referred to. And during that time, they actually really relished the opportunity to have kind of a quiet moment, I suppose. It was the time of day when you might pray or meditate, perhaps. It was the time of day when you maybe had like light conversation with your family, but you certainly wouldn't have had contact with people outside of your household. And people really appreciated that time and saw it as very kind of valuable, as very relaxing. And then they'd go back to bed again and sleep until dawn. And that was totally normal. And I think in the winter, many of us are actually falling into that sleep pattern quite naturally, but we're fighting it. So we're pushing ourselves to stay awake for much longer than we want to and feeling tired and awful because of it. And then when we wake in the night, we panic and we think something's gone wrong. We think it's a disorder. And actually, I learned during my last wintering to get up, to just get up in the middle of the night. And I found that that anxiety dissolved straight away when I just acted on my impulse to be awake. And now I do it really regularly. I do go to bed really early anyway, because I'm not particularly rock and roll. But if I wake in the middle of the night, sorry to disappoint everyone. I know you're all thinking I was really excited. If I wake in the middle of the night, I get up and I keep the lights low. You know, I don't look at my screen at all. I don't switch the TV on. But I might read. I might meditate. I might do some knitting. I might write in my notebook. And I've come to really enjoy that time, actually. It's a time that I have completely to myself, you know, and like loads of parents, I feel stretched in many, many directions all day, every day. And I'm disappointed if I miss it now. It's a really soothing time for me.
I want to talk about your experience of celebrating the winter solstice at Stonehenge. First of all, Catherine, what sort of people show up for this?
Oh, everybody. I mean, imagine the kind of a person and they're there celebrating the solstice at Stonehenge, but it's completely glorious, actually. So just for anyone that doesn't know, Stonehenge was aligned originally so that the sun would set shortest day every year. And so now people gather, that stone has actually fallen down, so they gather to watch the sunrise through the henge. At the beginning of the end of that midwinter period. It's always on the 21st of December. And there's only two times in the year when you can actually walk up to the stones themselves. They take the fence down that's normally around it. So it's this incredibly privileged position to be in, wherein you can actually touch the stones. And I mean, I'm familiar with them. I've seen them so many times, and I've never been able to get up close to them before. And that was one of the reasons I wanted to do it, apart from also kind of morbid curiosity about what people got up to. So everybody gathered there was meaning to do a different thing there, but there was no conflict in that. So there were people that looked like they'd been partying all night, you know, in space suits and playing melodicas and drumming and all of that kind of thing and dancing. Apparently you get much more of that at the summer solstice though. And there were also people in kind of, I don't know, medieval dress. There were people dressed up as green men. There were Morris dancing troupes. There were kind of people like me in outdoor wear looking a bit awkward. There was choirs of people singing. There were all sorts of different instruments playing. Everything, absolutely all human life was happening there. And as the sun, as we got to the moment when the sun was about to rise, people packed into that central circle of the stones. And you got this real sense of this, you know, place as a place of worship, which I think we've completely left behind a long time ago. And it was really beautiful and really wonderful. And I came away from it thinking not only what a great thing it is to remember these old rituals, even if we don't quite know what they were, we do understand the purpose of them and we can sort of construct something around that, but also for there to be diversity in that, and that doesn't matter. We don't have to fight over that. We can all just get together with a similar purpose and do it in different ways in a very happy way. It was beautiful.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. The certainty of the date, there's something really priceless in that too, right? Because in our metaphorical winters, we're never quite sure if we've actually lived through the darkest day. I guess we're not quite sure even in our physical, literal winters, we're not quite sure if we've lived through the coldest day yet.
Yeah, I think that's really true. And I think we often only know that in retrospect, actually. And a bit like the real winters, there's quite often a surprise cold day well after we think the spring's coming. Mm-hmm. And yeah, and if we see our wintering as a kind of narrative arc or a story, I think we can understand that really well. And then when we're living through it, we just have to kind of go with what it demands on a day-to-day basis. We don't really get to steer it that much. We don't really get to choose what happens. We just have to walk within it and try and be present for it. And that's, you know, that's very hard. And that's a skill, I think.
All right, I want to take a phone call. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. We have Jim on the line in Fort Worth, Texas. Hi, Jim.
Hi, Chris. Catherine, this is Jim.
Hi, Jim.
Hi, Catherine. Kindred spirit, I think. I just turned 79, and I'm realizing that there are a lot of things that I can't go back and do over, and a lot of things I can't go back and do for the first time, and that's an incredible grief and loss, and sometimes I feel like I was living somebody else's agenda, and you know, to please another people, and I missed out on a lot of things, and I figure I'll have to deal with that for the rest of my life, and I'm going to turn my phone off and see what you've got to say. Thank you.
Thanks for calling, Jim.
Thank you, Jim. That's really heartbreaking, isn't it? I think we all have those feelings about how we've, I don't know, yeah, as he said, like so often done what other people thought we should do rather than live for ourselves. And I wonder if this year is a bit of an awakening for that, about how short life is and how we need to do what we've got to do sometimes and not worry about conventions so much, maybe.
So your son's anxiety about school was something you'd been aware of, but you say you hadn't quite been hearing him properly when he was telling you how he was feeling. How did you realize he needed a break?
Yeah, I'd been bubbling along in the background. And, you know, I think with kids quite often you don't know how seriously to take them. Their emotions are very intense, and they're very intense one direction, one moment, and the next moment that seems to be completely resolved. But it took me a while to notice this pattern of him really not wanting to be at school, of being very panicky about it, being very upset all evening and very upset all morning. And we got to the point where we just had done everything we could to alleviate his suffering, and he was really suffering. And, you know, we tried to work with the school and weren't getting a lot of interest from them, if I'm completely honest about it. A lot of dismissal, you know, a lot of, well, you just have to force him into it. There's nothing else you can do. And I think I suddenly thought, do you know what? I don't want to force him into this. He's 6 years old. In many countries in the world, he wouldn't have even been going to proper school yet. In the UK, we start, you know, formally schooling kids really young. And I thought, well, this is a real crossroads for us, because do we make a decision to tell him that he has to suck it up and that his feelings don't really matter, and what matters is him conforming to what are actually quite sort of arbitrary standards of what we think kids could be achieving if we push them hard enough at that stage in his life? Or do I teach him how to meet his own needs? And, you know, when I thought about it, it wasn't really a choice. I knew I had to withdraw him from school and let him settle again so that he could get back his equilibrium and we could fight the sort of terror that had overtaken him. And so that's what we did. We pulled him out of school.
My guest is journalist and author Catherine May. We're talking about her new book. It's called Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat. This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with journalist and author Catherine May about her new book, Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, as you committed to teaching your son at home, at least for a while, how did the rhythm of both of your days change?
An awful lot, I think, is the answer to that. I mean, I have to say I was never a parent who ever had an ambition to be a homeschooler. I'd always kind of admired the people that did it and always thought they had exceptional patience, really, that I didn't maybe possess. But being kind of forced to make that decision, I had to think about how we were going to approach that. And I knew really clearly that it just wouldn't have worked for us to have done formal schooling, you know, to sit down every day and to work through, you know, an hour of maths, an hour of literature, whatever. So I decided to let him lead what he wanted to do. Like, my only insistence was that we had to get outdoors as much as possible. So we went to the woods, we built dens. I quite often would plan like what I thought was a really cunning activity. You know, we'd go to the woods with crayons and paper and I was going to make bark rubbings. But he had this way of subverting that every single time. And at first, that frustrated me massively. You know, I had an agenda. I can stay in control of this. But actually, I realized that he was often doing the learning that he needed to do at that moment. And quite a lot of that was developmental. So often when I wanted to do something imaginative, he wanted to do something practical and vice versa. And so I had to really, chill out a bit and let him lead and to try and pick up on his cues and signals about what he wanted to do. That did us both a lot of good, actually. He had some things that he wanted to work through that he couldn't do at school. And maybe that was because he was a little bit young in his year and, you know, he was a little bit behind everybody else in terms of where he was at. So we worked with him and I yet again had to find more patience and try and be a slightly better person. I'm not saying I fully succeeded, but I did my best.
Well, sure, because the attention he needed from you was attention that necessarily couldn't go to your own projects. How did you come to terms with that?
I found that incredibly hard. You know, I don't think we talk enough about the hardship that we feel when we're kept away from the things we love. And I think it's particularly hard for like creative people or for people who are a kind of project based, who like to follow their own whims and desires and ideas. And I felt, I mean, not just frustrated, but kind of angry and so churned up by it. And, you know, once again, those big fears come up, not the small stuff, not the kind of, oh, I might not be able to make any work today, But the big stuff, the big kind of paranoid thoughts that that's it, I'm never going to be anything. I'm never going to be able to get back into the mainstream world again. That's it. My life is over. And I had to, interestingly, when I got a break, you know, the moments when my husband would take over childcare, for example, I found that I couldn't sit down and work as I expected to, because I couldn't switch it on and off. And so I had to learn to go out and walk to just try and recover myself a little bit and try and find my own equilibrium, which is ironic, seeing as I was trying to teach him to find his.
I want to talk about snow days. You mentioned it doesn't snow all that often where you are. This show's produced in Texas, so it's so rare that, like, we've been talking for 2 weeks about one day when it might snow for 45 minutes this coming weekend. But yeah. The thing that I always love when it does snow is even just a couple of inches, everything is quiet in a way that it never is. And you can sort of notice things smell different. What is it that you love about snowy days?
Oh, all of that. I mean, it snowed here today for the first time properly in, I think, maybe 3 years. And I can't stop looking at it. Like, the moment you wake up, the light comes differently through your curtains. And everything is transformed. It's like the world's made fresh and new again. It's so beautiful. I live about 5 minutes walk from the beach. And for me, it carries on surprisingly that a beach can be snowy too. Like, it's not a landscape we associate with snow. And I just, as soon as it snows, I can't wait to get down there and see the snow drifting along the wave breaks and the sea bashing up against those snowy parts of the beach. I just love it. I think it's magical.
You've gone swimming in icy water deliberately?
Yes, I have. Yeah. I learned to do that during writing the book. I was invited along to try cold water swimming. And as it turned out, nobody else turned up except for me and one other person. And the first time I got in, I honestly thought I was going to die. I mean, I really thought, the weird thing about getting into very cold water is that for about 30 seconds, it's probably not even as long as that, but it feels like it, all of the muscles in between your ribs tense up. And so it's hard to draw in a breath. And that's actually quite scary.
Yeah.
But once I'd got through that and got back out of the water and known I'd survived it, I felt really euphoric and I carried on. I've carried on ever since. In fact, I swam today in a snowstorm. I weirdly saw it as an opportunity to try it rather than seeing it as a terrible thing that I shouldn't do. So I was in a blizzard this morning swimming.
So how
it was really cold.
How do you warm up when you get back home?
I have a whole routine, actually. So I always bring a flask of tea to the beach with me, and that helps genuinely to kind of warm up from the inside. And I have one of those great big dry robes. So I get loads of layers of clothes on, I get my dry robe on, I swim in a hat, I change hat when I come out. I put gloves on, I put thick socks on, and I walk home really briskly to warm up. And by then it's normally okay, you know. In fact, if you can avoid doing stuff to warm yourself up, it's the best thing, because it doesn't help to, say, get under a hot shower or sit in a warm bath. That just makes your skin burn. It doesn't help to sit in front of a hot fire. You need to actually warm up gradually and to try and harness your body's heat to warm up. And behind all of that is the discipline of not getting too cold, you know, knowing when to come out of the water, not pushing yourself too far to try and impress anyone or to time yourself against a clock. The water's a different temperature every day. You have to really learn to engage with what your body's telling you. And I think that's one of the things that actually makes it very relaxing. You know, it's mindful. You are drawn right into that present moment, and you have to take care of yourself during the time you're in the cold water, because, you know, you don't want to catch hypothermia, not to put too fine a point on it. And so, yeah, I think if you're worrying about warming up, you've probably gone too far. It's surprising how well your body does if you get out in good time.
So I don't know if this is the case in the UK. In the US, especially in the southern parts that aren't used to having a lot of snow, we have, you know, snow days where it's determined to be too icy or too snowy for kids to get to school, and they get this surprise day off out of nowhere. And now because of the pandemic and because of the rise of virtual learning, a lot of districts have said, we're not going to do this anymore. If the weather's too bad to get to school, you can just flip on your tablet and we'll learn this way. And my kids are all out of high school, but I'm sort of sad for the kids who won't experience this magic day off.
I'm so sad about that. You know, we just have this terrible way of erasing all the magic, don't we? Like, snow days, they're so few and far between. And in the countries that have a lot of snow, you know, they don't have snow days every time it snows. They push the boundary further. So like in Finland, I think it has to be 17 below freezing for them to have a snow day. And so actually what that means is that we all get our equal snow days. We get one or two a year. And isn't that just the most magical thing? In fact, my son's school today, hopefully they're not going in the same direction as yours, because they emailed a couple of days ago to say, snow's predicted. If it comes, don't worry. We're going to suspend the lessons for a day so the kids can play. And I think that's exactly right. It's part of the magic of childhood, and that glee at getting an extra day off should not be disrupted.
So to what extent has COVID felt like wintering for you?
I think it's felt like a mass wintering in many ways. I think it feels like we've all been pushed very quickly into this space where we are isolated and frustrated and worried. And, you know, the thing is that it's for lots of different reasons. People are suffering in loads of different ways in this pandemic. And that doesn't necessarily mean that we all feel like there's a commonality in our suffering. Actually, it can mean that we're all looking towards each other and thinking, oh, you know, maybe my suffering isn't valid because somebody else has got it much worse. Or maybe we're looking in the opposite direction and thinking, I don't know why that person's complaining, you know, they're not going through what I'm going through. I would say that it's pointing us very interestingly to the transformation that happens in a wintering as well. You know, I don't think anyone's enjoying this particularly. I think some of us are better adapted to it than others, though. And in many ways, for me, it's been quite a comfortable space to be in. It feels quite familiar, and I feel like I've got some strategies for coping with it. But I've still been very bored, obviously. But I'm seeing loads of people making changes to their life now. They've had this time to reflect. They've been through a period of having space or of, you know, changing their routine. And I'm hearing lots and lots of people who are, you know, going to move house, going to move to a different town, going to change jobs, going to retrain. You know, I do know a couple of people that are getting divorced, but perhaps that's not the ideal change. But it's really interesting that it's having this effect on us and that we are seeing people being able to move to a different stage in their life because they've had this break. I think there's going to be lots of surprises in the next few years, actually.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So is growth after winter inevitable, or does wintering require something of us to facilitate that growth?
I think it probably does, actually. I mean, I think we all can think of examples of people who have been through a wintering and have perhaps never come out again, who've just carried on in that wintry space. I think wintering can lead to growth. And I think that happens if we are able to let our winter in, if we're able to look it in the eye and really engage with the change that it's bringing us, whether that's a welcome change or not. If we can do that, and I don't think that's by any means impossible, I really do think it can lead to growth afterwards. You know, if nothing else, we grow in wisdom every time this stuff happens to us. We dig deeper into our wells of compassion. We gain an understanding of other people and how their lives work. And hopefully, if we allow ourselves, we gain insights into us. And I do think that we actually can't become wise in life if we haven't wintered. It's the grit in the oyster. It's the process that we need to go to, painful as it is, in order to learn and grow, I think. Yeah.
You went to see the Northern Lights as a kind of a last trip as childless people when you and your husband were expecting your son, and you discovered they don't necessarily look like the most amazing National Geographic photographs we've all seen. You describe them requiring a sort of different kind of looking, at least when you were there to see them.
Yeah, you have to get your eye in for the Northern Lights. And I think that really took me by surprise. I'd seen, as everyone has, amazing footage of them moving across the sky, kind of bright green, really almost sort of psychedelic. And that's what I was expecting to see. And actually, in person, they're really quite pale. I mean, they're so pale that the stars shine through them. And a lot of people say, well, that's disappointing. I don't think it is disappointing at all. You know, they demand something of you. They demand your full engagement. And once you've learned to see them, you see them everywhere. And that was completely a surprise to me. So I'd gone on they call it like Northern Lights hunting trip, deep into the night, heavily pregnant, in a snowsuit. And finally managed to see these stunning Northern Lights over a lake. And then the next day, just spotted them so much more easily. It was like I'd learned a skill, and I felt like I'd been inducted into a secret, I suppose. And now I would dearly love to see them again, because I'd love to know if I'd see them so easily again, or whether I'd have to learn it all over again. That would be fascinating to find out.
Did you feel compelled to try to photograph them, or did you just want to experience it?
Oh, I tried. They are very, very hard to photograph, actually. I gather that our mobile phone technology has moved on now, but you have to have a very long exposure to capture them at all. I mean, it's another sign of how kind of ephemeral they are, I think. But yeah, it was, I tried for a while and realized I was failing, and then thought, stop it, just be there. Just be there and watch them. Why do we have to capture everything? I can show everyone that National Geographic footage afterwards and pretend it looked like that. And that's how the lie continues.
Catherine May is a journalist and author of the book Wintering, The Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. Catherine, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you for making time for us.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely.
You can like our page on Facebook. We're on Twitter at KERA Think. Subscribe to the podcast free wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.